Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. Hello to our listeners. Great to be with you again at our probably last episode of the year. And what a year it was again. I'm not sure about all of you, but I'm certainly looking forward to hopefully a calm, relaxing end of the year. But that feels like quite the tall order in our times.
Indeed. With so many wars and conflicts on the rise and not the best of the prospects in the climate and the environmental fronts, we'd like to dedicate this year's last episode, probably last episode, to the most affected people, to those sections of society who are marginalized and who are highly exposed to the consequences of both climate change and conflicts, for those who have the least contributed to it and also that have the least resources to cope with it. And for this, we have a special guest today, Hind Aliriani. She's a journalist, a writer, and an activist on women, peace, and security from Yemen. Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, Hind.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
So Hind, I said you are a special guest, and the reason for this is how your work advocating for women's and LGBTQ plus rights has affected your personal life and your security as well, to the point that you were forced to seek asylum. And maybe you can tell us a bit about how you got to where you are today.
Well, that's a long story, a bit dramatic, but I will try to make it short. I've been advocating for women and children's rights and minorities' rights for a long time. First, it was always like receiving threats, but they were always online, so I didn't take them seriously. But it got worse when I criticized first a cleric who lives in Taiz. A girl there was raped, and she was only 8 years old. And he said that this is because of the way that children are wearing these days, the girls. So I was so mad. And I said, this man should go to jail because he's giving excuses to criminals. So then they wrote about it in the New Arab newspaper, and a lot of his followers were mad, but I didn't care much. They just wrote online. Then I criticized another one who was actually Al-Qaeda member. He was saying that women shouldn't work because they will mix with men. And also he said, women who are not covering their face are ugly. So I just put my picture and said, I'm ugly and proud. I thought it's funny or just teasing. So he was apparently offended. And then it got worse when Houthi's group, they put me on Yemen TV, which is the official Yemen TV. But now they are controlling it. And of course, you know about Houthis, especially recently you heard names. And they said that I'm trying to destroy the society, which is true somehow. And they put my picture and they said, you will get respond for what you are saying. And then we received threats, me and my daughter. And then we had to leave Turkey to Sweden, where my family here before us, they came here 3 years before us.
And your advocacy work in Yemen now, we'd like to get into a little bit of the topics in addition to women, peace, and security that Raquel mentioned. And your advocacy work in Yemen has covered other important topics like combating drug use and supporting religious minorities. And I'm curious to know if you've always had a gender perspective in your work, and are some of these topics that you've been a long-term advocate for, are they still a part of your advocacy work in the realm of women, peace, and security?
Yes, when it comes to anti-cut campaign, which has to do with sustainability and also with climate, because cut is affecting the water, because it needs a lot of water, like 70% of water goes to cut, and those the economy and others, and the agriculture. So I was always making sure that the groups that we made groups in 5 cities in Yemen, there were girls leading these groups. And we were always also making sure that when we visit the school for awareness, that we go to girls' school as well. When it comes to minority, my part, I was like a mediator to release 6 Baha'is. Baha'is are religion. And one of them was facing death penalty. They were going to execute him. So it was a very bad situation. And when it comes to minorities, whether LGBTQ plus rights or the religious minority, not many people care about their issues. And it becomes more dangerous for them, especially during conflicts. So a mediator was in contact with the Houthis. I had to talk with them and with the UN envoy at that time, the previous one. And we succeeded to release them. They went back to their families.
That's amazing.
Now, I'm still working also on this issue about raising awareness about the people who are arrested or trying to advocate for their release.
So that was quite a lot of things going on. We tried to summarize it in a few minutes, but there's just in so many directions. Even, for example, I didn't know that cat was associated with water use. I mean, we're here, we talk a lot about climate and environment. So this was an interesting one, but also all these aspects for minorities, religious minorities, women and girls and children. There's just so much there that you have addressed. Super interesting. I think we're going to get back at those individual points and throughout our different questions that we will ask you. Let's just take a look now at the broader Yemen context. Maybe some of our listeners might not know very well. The country has been in civil war since 2014, and there's also so much going on in this context. And we see in international news a lot, what is brought to attention is generally the regional geopolitics, right? And how this, to a great extent, has this proxy war of foreign powers going on within the country. And I wanted to know from you to what extent this is accurate, the things that we see in international media, and also what are the key local dynamics that are missing from this media reporting that could help us understand how Yemen came to be in its current state?
Yes, first, you are correct about the proxy war. And there are groups related to several countries like Iran, Saudi, and Emirates. And it has to do with what's happening now, what we see now. For example, the Houthis group is related to Iran, Russia, China, and this is what is called the resistance axis, but it also has a history, this conflict. Before the revolution of 1962, we had another kind of governance. They were called imamates. It was like a kingdom, families that were ruling Yemen, and they were saying that they had the right to rule because they are related to Prophet Muhammad. So it was a religious somehow. And now they are back through Houthis saying the same thing, that they have the right because they are related to the prophets. So this is how it's not just about what's happening now. It also has a root in the history.
So now let's continue to stay focused on Yemen. And I also want to bring in this environmental climate change aspect a little bit stronger as well. And for some of our listeners who tune in on a monthly basis, in our August podcast episode, one of the featured Peace Pillar projects that we discussed, Environmental Pathways for Reconciliation in Yemen, focuses on voicing the needs and priorities of Yemenis, and it was established to support civil society to help address these risks related to climate, environment, and of course, conflict. And during this interview, Hisham Omezi, one of the people working on the project from the European Institute of Peace, shared that in a survey they had conducted that despite governmental perceptions, society was actually very aware of how climate change was impacting the security of people and also conflict in general. And I'm curious to know if you've also experienced this kind of awareness in your work, and if you've seen any kind of good examples of community-driven dialogue and programming that are addressing some of these really big, really complex topics, really from this society and community-driven approach.
Yes, Hisham actually is my friend. So
amazing, unsurprising, but amazing.
Yeah, we all know.
It's really one community.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So when it comes to awareness, people, of course, they see what climate change is doing to their lives. They see water scarcity, more floods, more problems with farming. But they need awareness to know about how to adapt to these problems, why it's happening, what can they do. Of course, this is needed. Problem is, some people, even some educated people, they think talking about climate change is not a priority because Yemen is going through conflicts, whatever. But it's the opposite, because when there is conflict and there is a problem of climate change, the people cannot get help because there is no government. There is only groups fighting. So people are more vulnerable. So there is a need of more awareness and people to know how to adapt and how to solve these problems. So there are examples of communities, because you asked me, and I will talk about women specifically, since I'm not natural when it comes to women. So there are two women. One of them is Noha Alban. She lives in Abs. And this woman is a part of a committee, and their goal is to help the farmers. And she was giving awareness to the farmers how they can help each other, how they can save their resources. And also she helped in solving conflicts between this. The other woman is Iman Hadi. Iman Hadi is from Lahj, and this area has a lot of displacement and, of course, a lot of conflict. But what she did with other 9 women, they proposed for a solar system project. So it was the first private solar system in this area. So they helped their community to have electricity. Actually, last year, she attended the conference in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, and it was a long journey for her because it's very hard to leave Yemen. But I was very happy that she got the attention.
Thank you. And you already started talking about it. We know that wars always hit hardest on the most fragile populations. I mean, that's how we started the podcast, right? We wanted to highlight specifically that. So we have the current war in Yemen, certainly is affecting women disproportionately, like it is generally the case in most or every conflict. Also because of women's roles as carers, taking care of other fragile groups, like children, like the elderly, like people with disability. So a lot of things there. And I'd like to hear from you how this is playing out specifically in the Yemen context, but also what was the situation of women's and also women's rights prior to the war? Have we seen that in several parts of the world, some places have become more conservative than they were before? So how did women feature in traditional Yemeni culture and society? Or have you noticed or have you heard from women around you that the situation has already been deteriorating on the lead up to the conflict?
Okay, so there are these two separate questions. So I will talk about first how things changed for women's rights in Yemen. There is a big change. Before the war, we were talking about, of course, child marriage, about having more women in the parliament because there were only one woman, about violence against women. But now we are losing the rights that we used to have. Like, for example, the rights to movement. Now women, they cannot move without their guardian approving or coming with them, which is very hard when there is a war. Many men are not there if they are fighting or if they had to, like they cannot be there. And this affected a lot of women who are working in the civil society. And there is a relative of mine. She has an organization. And she's a leader in civil society. And last time she couldn't go to another city to do some projects there because they said your guardian should approve. And she's divorced. And she has only one boy who is 15 years old. Her brothers, they left the country already. So she had to take her son. And he was saying, I'm sorry, mom. He felt that this is not okay. He said, I'm sorry that I have to do that. Also, they are trying to separate men from women in universities. They did that in Sana'a University. The media section, they separated men and women. In Taiz, it's not possible even to do events. If there are women, they start to shooting. So they are trying to make women not to practice any activities. So this is like isolating women. So it's very, very bad. I used to travel around Yemen, outside Yemen. Nobody ever asked me that my father should approve or whatever. But now it's totally different. And when it comes to the other section about climate change and the conflict, if you see old pictures of Yemeni women, you will see them always, the farmers always fetching for water. So it's their job, always women, to find the water and to provide water and food and to take care of the families, as you mentioned, and the people who need help in their family. So now it's very hard because of climate change. They have to walk more distance to find water. And because of the conflict, this is very dangerous because there are landmines, especially around areas where there is water resources. And also you can get shot from anywhere if you go far away from where you live. So it's very dangerous for women and it's affecting their lives.
Earlier in your answer, you touched already a bit about women's representation. And as a part of your work, you're a member of the Yemeni Women's Pact for Peace and Security, which is a UN women's program to advocate for Yemeni women's increased participation in leadership and official peace processes, and to enhance gender equality perspectives in peace building and reconstruction processes within the country. How does the pact work? And if you could provide a little bit of information of what kind of activities are part of it and some of the key challenges that are behind it and its creation.
So the pact or Tawafuq is there are around 60 women who are already leaders in the civil society and different subjects, and they work in different level of the peace track. And I can tell you about an example of what they do. Like there is Ma'in al-Ubaidi. She was helping in exchanging prisoners between groups that have conflicts, also in solving conflicts in Taiz, in her city. There are other women also working in other things, like giving awareness about the need of women to be in the peace process. And most of them, actually 80% of them, are in Yemen, which is very challenging. And because they come from different political backgrounds, it's very, very challenging to be together in one group, especially now during the war. And because of the war, many times they weren't able even to be in a Zoom meeting because they are not allowed. The government there, if you call it a government, like the Houthis, they wouldn't allow them to be in a meeting. And because they are linked to the UN Women, then there is accusation that you are being part of international organizations, then you are doing bad, you are harming the country. There was a big campaign against all the civil society, the organizations. They were saying that they are working against the country. And these campaigns, they do it because they want to make the civil society even weaker, because the civil societies, they have no one but the international organizations to support them. And there is no government, and this is the only way to support these organizations, especially for women who cannot travel outside Yemen, who cannot get any funding. They don't have contacts. So the only contacts they have is the international organizations that are there in Yemen. So these are the challenges that they faced. And also because they're coming from different political backgrounds, this is the only group that they have different political backgrounds. I remember something also. Yeah. They work also in consultancy for the UN envoy also. And there are some of them also, they were part of the new consultations that with the government. So they work in different level and different issues.
Thanks. I think we already touched upon a few points of how climate change is entering into this equation. But just to like hit a nail on the head now and look at it from the climate perspective directly, we know that the Middle East is severely impacted by climate change in its particularly water scarce region. I think Yemen has had its fair share of water related internal conflicts in the past 3-4 decades. In fact, we even have a few case studies in our platform from the ECC Factbook that outline some of these conflicts in detail. We can link them here in the description in case our listeners want to learn more about this. But what would you say that climate change and environmental degradation as well, to bring that also into the mix, have played a role in the political fragmentation and also the conflicts that we see today in Yemen?
Yeah, it played a big role because the climate change raised the conflicts in areas where there is water scarcity. For example, the several groups, they are competing for the water and for the land. So this raised the problem. And as I said before, when there is no government, when there is a conflict, it becomes even worse. So the climate change is causing more conflicts, and also being in a country that is unstable will make the climate change even worse, the output of it. So both, it works on both sides.
So one of the big topics that's always on the table is finance. And in our October episode with Special Advisor on Climate Action to the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Andrew Harper made the case that when climate finance flows directly to women, it's in much better hands in terms of fair and efficient use and also distribution. And I guess our question for you is, do you agree with this? And if you could, and if you do, if you could share any examples of locally led action on climate adaptation or environmental restoration, and how women have led some of those processes and projects.
Yes, definitely. Because everything we said in this podcast is proving that if you give it to the woman, if you finance women, then you will have more benefit, will be more beneficial for the whole community. I mentioned that women are responsible for fetching water and also for taking care of the family and their community, especially now when men, a lot of them, they are not there either fighting or. So women have more responsibility now. So when you are helping women, you are helping the whole community. You are supporting them to work more in solving conflicts and helping the farmers. So it's very important to support women and that the funds go to organizations that are led by women in Yemen, inside Yemen, on the ground.
Thanks. And I think for our last question of our conversation today, taking a little bit of a different approach and looking at the foreign policy angle. And since 2014, feminist foreign policies are becoming more and more widespread, with Germany adopting its own feminist foreign policy in 2021 and publishing guidelines earlier this year. And of course, these guidelines consist of internal and external measures. But just to zoom in a little bit on one of the Foreign Office's goals when it comes to the allocation of project funding. So staying on this topic for one last round. And by 2025, the German Federal Foreign Office is aiming for 85% of project funding to be allocated in a way that acknowledges the needs of women and marginalized groups. So we've already touched quite a bit upon what happens when climate finance flows directly to women and when they're in leadership roles and have a say in what's done with these funds and for different projects. But now to take a little bit of a wider look at the topic, and if we have this kind of goal of this 85% project funding being allocated in a way that acknowledges these needs, how could that change the kind of nature of the projects that are being funded in Yemen as positive, as well as are there any obstacles or barriers that might be unforeseen in these kinds of really big goals?
Yes, first, thank you to Germany, because I've been to Germany also to attend. They were talking about feminist policy. And it's great because there are less and less countries that give attention to this subject, unfortunately, even in Europe. So I hope that they will not forget Yemen. And as we said, Yemen is a very fragile country because of the war and because Yemen now is controlled by several religious groups, not one group. And every area has its conflicts, and women who work with civil society now, they are weaker, because when the civil society gets weaker, when there is a group militia ruling the country. So these projects, if it goes through international organizations, of course, they can reach to the local organizations there that are working on climate change, and they have gender lenses and they're focusing on women, especially now that, as we mentioned already, that women cannot even fetch water because of the conflict, and they can't even move around the country because if they don't have anyone to come with them. Even in areas where they called it under the government ruling, and they don't allow women to stay in hotel alone. So if a woman coming from Sana'a to Aden, for example, she has to be with someone, otherwise she can't. And most projects are happening there in the south. So there is important to focus on areas where they are not getting much attention because there are some groups, but at the same time to make sure that these groups are not taking advantage of these projects and getting the money to them, for example. And this is very, I know, very complicated, but I know it can be done.
Hin spoke about how her advocacy of women, children, LGBTQ plus communities, religious minorities, and even anti-drugs has led her to seek political refuge in Sweden. And she has also explained to us how women's rights have deteriorated in Yemen in recent times, such as the right to move without approval of a guardian, something which is also affecting the work of women who are active in civil society groups. Things like separation in universities and in media are effectively isolating women from social life since the conflict has started. She's highlighted how climate change impacts women's ability to do their traditional tasks, such as to fetch water, farm, and take care of families. But with climate change increasing the ways to collect water, and with the conflict also making it more dangerous with landmines and shootings, the situation has been deteriorating very fast. She has also explained how climate change has played a role in the internal conflicts, the Keriti, which in turn exacerbated the current insecurity scenario in the country. Hind has also made the case that women are in a better position to use and distribute climate funding, particularly in a context of ongoing insecurity, in which men are often engaged in armed conflict. She's also praised Germany's efforts to bring a feminist perspective to the center of its foreign policy strategy, which is something that a few other countries are pursuing as well, and hopes that this gender lens will catch on, hopefully not leaving behind countries that need it the most, such as Yemen.
This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We'll be back with another episode in a few weeks. Follow our latest updates on Twitter at Climate Diplo. And thank you very much for tuning in and for joining us, Hind. And until next time, next year, goodbye.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye. Thank you.
Thank you.